Welcome to Paradigm Shifters. Paradigm Shifters are people who are making a difference on the planet with new perceptions, new inventions, always a different thought paradigm. One way to shift your paradigm is to die and then come back to life. We've heard a lot of people doing near life and near death experiences these days, and our guest today, Ken Boynton, has had, is this right, Ken? You've had two of these experiences?
Yes, my wife and I like to say that we have four between us.
So you shared, did you share the wealth? Does that mean you both shared the outcome, which was different perceptions, different paradigms?
Well, the perspective was a little different. I was unconscious for the first one, but since she was by me in the hospital telling me not to die, I feel like she was a big part of that one. Mm-hmm. And then about 3 months after that, we were on a trip and got into a gigantic car accident in a cab on the 10 in LA. And the car tipped up on two wheels and narrowly missed hitting the barrier between the freeway oncoming lanes and us. And so that one I was awake for, and I much prefer being unconscious for the near-death experiences rather than awake.
Oh, wow. So before we go into what all of that looked like or seems like to you, let's talk about who you are. This is Ken Boynton. I haven't talked to you for many years, and we were kind of friends over there in Squim, Washington for a long time. You were a performer, an amazing singer, songwriter, comedian. Oh, my goodness, such a talented man. And I think, I'm not sure, but did you do stand-up?
Yes. Yeah, for about 5 years I did stand-up as well. There was a point in my life where I didn't really want to go to work for a company. I just wanted to exploit myself for money as much as possible. So
you had a lot of fun, and you brought a lot of fun, that much I remember.
Yeah, and you know, whatever you're good at, if you can get paid to do it, I think that's a plus.
And you're still doing that, Ken, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and what are you doing now? You're also doing voiceovers. You're doing a lot of media kinds of things, right?
Yep, I've always done voiceover. That's sort of been, I like to call it my day job for about 20 years. And then, you know, I would do other things, other performance things with music and comedy and those types of things. And I've always been a writer, and I've always written for other people as well as myself. And so I started, as the voiceover world is sort of, you know, youth related, and as I got a little bit older, I started concentrating more on the writing side. And so my wife and I have a company now called Message Glue, where I write communications for companies all over the world, and she helps presenters be better on stage. So she's the coach and I'm the writer.
Oh, what a wonderful combination. So you coach and write for each other, I'll bet you, huh?
Yeah, it's really, we work together, and I used to do a little coaching, but some clients would ask for that. And then I met Anna about 12 years ago, and I realized that she's so much better at it than I am, better than anybody I've ever seen do it. So it was easy to let that part go and just concentrate on the writing side.
Well, and you've had a long sort of spiritual history as well, if I remember correctly.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I have. I've done just a little bit of everything.
That's a good metaphysician. So let's jump into this near-death experience situation and the wonderful book that you sent me called Blip.
Mm-hmm.
I love the title, Blip. So why don't you talk about what you experienced in your near-death experience? Like, was it, do you recall visual, just tell us a little bit about it. Did you enter a different field of comprehension? Did you get visions? What happened?
Well, I remember saying, boy, if I had died during that, it was complications from H1N1, the swine flu pandemic that happened in 2009. We were on a business trip to Baton Rouge, and someone in the hotel where we were working, we believe, coughed all over our toothbrushes. Anna and I both got sick. She heard the maid cleaning up and said she just had this horrible cough. And So we both ended up getting sick, and after about a day and a half, she got better and I got worse. And that was over the course of a weekend, like feeling a little tickle on Friday morning, and on Monday morning at 4 a.m., I got taken to the emergency room at Tulane Medical Center down in New Orleans, and that began this day-long many doctors saying he's going to die. My kidneys failed. I was septic. They just kept telling Anna to go make arrangements because I wasn't going to survive. And she kept saying, that will be something that I'll do if he doesn't survive. But for the time being, I think I'll sit here. And
for her.
Yeah, I was very, very glad to have her. Then they,
were you conscious then?
In and out. It was a very weird, state to be in, because I was aware that things were not great. And there was some, you know, there's some humor in there too, because one of the doctors was this like amazingly beautiful man who came in with long hair and puka shells. And I thought, oh, wow, that'd be weird if that was Jesus. And he's like cruising in here to go, okay, you're out.
So you thought you might be on your way out, huh?
I knew something was wrong, but I wasn't concerned about it. That was the thing that I thought was most fascinating. I knew that Anna was upset. I couldn't express myself. I couldn't talk really. In my mind, I would talk. I heard myself talking, but then the responses from other people made it clear that they either weren't listening to me or they couldn't understand what I was saying. And as I found out later, I was just babbling. I wasn't making any coherent sounds. But in my head, there were crystal clear, logical thoughts. And I explained things to nurses who then said, oh, he doesn't know what day it is. And I thought, I just told you the timeline very specifically. And so the rest of the time, I was sort of drifting in and out of consciousness. And I never heard them say he's not going to make it. I never heard them tell her to go, you know, make arrangements. I knew she was concerned. I actually managed to say a couple words to Anna when they were trying to figure me out, that I got out as words, which was a kind of a triumph. But even in the midst of that,
that's awful. It's like being trapped in your own mind and can't.
That's the thing that you would think, but I didn't feel trapped. I didn't feel anxious. I just felt like there were steps that I needed to take to try. I thought, okay, I have to really, really try to get out something that's going to make Anna feel better. Mm-hmm. I got three words out. Oh, so beautiful. And at which time the doctors laughed and said, oh, he knows her. But of course, it didn't really help her, because I don't usually talk to her like that. Oh, so beautiful.
Maybe you should, Ken.
Yeah, well, I do say that to her. I just don't say it in that weak tone of voice. But then as time went on, she was explaining to me that my temperature needed to be at a certain number, because I was covered in ice blankets. My fever was really, really high. I was lying on ice and covered with ice. And I was aware of that being uncomfortable, because they kept telling me I couldn't shiver, because that created more heat. I didn't like the ice blankets. Apparently I was trying to like move my thin hospital gown around to make it look like I was covering myself up. Right. But she kept saying to me, this is, you know, you need to hit this number. And so I would concentrate on hitting that number, even though part of my mind was doing the math and converting that number to Fahrenheit, which I know the formula, it's 9/5 + 32. I was getting like 108, 109. And I thought, that's way too high. And later I asked a doctor, I said, is there a different formula for Celsius Fahrenheit conversion when it's body temperature? And he said, no. And I said, well, when I was doing the math, when Anna was telling me what my temperature was, and you round up, you go 2 times the Celsius plus 32, you don't have to do 9/5. So it's, you know, it's pretty much 9/5 is almost 10/5, which is the number 2. So I was using my math skills and coming up with these. I said I came up with like 108, 109. And the doctor looked at me and said, you had a high fever. You were doing bad math, which I thought was fascinating because it was funny to him. But I never felt, I never felt worried. I never felt scared. I never felt any impending doom. At the same time, I never went down a tunnel toward the light. And I used to say to people that, you know, if I had died during that experience, having, you know, not done that typical sort of near-death experience that you hear about, I would have felt very cheated.
Yeah, well, you, also being an entertainer, you want it to be kind of like a lively performance, don't you think?
You want some, yeah, I want a music track to on that tunnel.
Anyway, so when you went through all that, so you're saying you didn't have like a transcendent visual thing, or you didn't have a meeting with Jesus or beings of great reputation or whatever. Is that right?
Right. And some people did say, well, then you weren't that close to death. And I thought, oh, okay. It's like, it was a kind of a weird, felt like a weird judgment to put on it. Well, then you didn't really almost die. You almost died.
That's it was, our cynical society anyway.
Yeah, we're like, you know, it was, I wouldn't recommend going through it. And it does cause changes that ripple through your life, certainly.
That's what I want us to talk about. Yeah. What kind of paradigm shifting literally in your brain, in your thoughts, in your experiences? I want you to share that.
Well, okay, let's see. So one of the things that I have said to people since then is that if you have changes that you've been waiting to make in your life, borrow one of our near-death experiences because they're very unpleasant and you shouldn't you shouldn't make yourself go through that. Just go ahead and make the change.
That's pretty cheeky because, hey, isn't it so, like, do you belong to the near-death experience study groups, the IANs and so on now?
I have not. I'm involved right now with some people that are sort of in the death industry. There's another author that we're kind of co-marketing our books together. She has a wonderful program called the Grief Dialogues, which is using theater to start conversations about grief and dying, but it's more focused on sort of what we're doing while we're here on the planet. And so that's, but I didn't want to skip the, you know, I didn't want to be cheeky and skip your epiphany question, because certainly you can't ignore, at least I couldn't ignore the sense that it's that close. Friday I was fine. Monday I was nearly dead. And for many people that, you don't even get the 2 days in the middle. Mm-hmm. And so at any moment, for a seemingly, you know, idiotic reason, you know, some woman coughs on a toothbrush and she has a flu virus and feels crappy and comes to work anyway. And I get the flu, but I'm in the 2% of people that it starts to try to destroy from the inside. Nobody knows why. The doctors don't know. They were not helpful as far as, you know, why did my kidneys come back to life? Why did they recover completely? Nobody knows. Hmm. Why did I get septic and it was creeping up my body and they could see it and they knew that they couldn't stop it? And why did it stop in reverse? Nobody knows. Mm-hmm. I was told that I might someday be a, you know, in a CDC study or something. Although I don't know how they would find
what's,
out.
What's a CDC study?
The Centers for Disease Control. Oh, okay. They, you know, they, mm-hmm. So it was a, that was a, you know, suddenly it was 2 weeks later. I'm completely weak. I can't stay awake more than about 20 minutes and then I'm sleeping for 3 hours. I lost my ability to read out loud, which was something as a voiceover artist that I've always been able to do really well. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't connect words to my mouth with that kind of facility. My armpit hair all disappeared.
Oh, you're kidding. How weird I mean, that is, eh?
Fever things like that happened. And I guess in Scarlet Fever or somewhere, that was one of the things a friend of mine told me, that that was something that happened. So physically, you're kind of, you know, knocked down to this place where I can't really, I have to kind of fight my way back. And it took about 8 months.
Wow.
And during that time, and, you know, in context, this was about, it happened a month or less than a month before my second anniversary. So, you know, Anna and I met each other a little bit later. So we were trying to maximize every second we get to have together. Mm-hmm. And this was, we'd just been married less than 2 years when this happened. And so I just wanted to go through it deeply conscious of the psychology and how people deal with trauma. Cause on this side of, you know, the being a human side.
So wait, when you're saying you wanted to go through it, you don't mean the marriage, you mean the sickness, the H1N1.
I wanted to go through the recovery, being very conscious about the psychology, because these are the kinds of things that cause issues in relationships when people don't deeply communicate about what, because it's terrifying to, you know, and more so for her. Like I said, I wasn't stressed. She was sitting there in a strange town,
wondering if you're going to live, right?
Yeah, I'm being told I wasn't over and over again,
mm-hmm.
Which is traumatic. So coming out of it, I wanted to really like apply a more scrutiny to like everyday life, I guess. Mm-hmm. We wanted to spend our moments that we had, and no one knows how many of those you get, and infuse them with as much meaning and as much joy and a much awakeness as we possibly could. And really that was that level, a friend of mine used this phrase the other day, level of urgency. That level of urgency for me instantly became much higher than it is for people who maybe haven't gone through.
So did you, I find that really interesting, actually. Did you find in your reverie when you were lying there and you weren't as anxious as poor Anna, who's waiting there for you to decide or to get better, and when you were speaking about reversing some of the health conditions and so on, did you have any, like, any visions in there, any suggestions that you were going to do that? Anything that would change your sense of what the power of these things is, or power over? Did you have anything like that?
With the fever, certainly, because I spent, I was fortunate enough to meet a Raja yoga master who, you know, goes back 5,000 years of masters. And I studied with him for about 5 years in the 90s. And he taught me a lot of relaxation and meditation and focusing and how to you know, bring things sort of into being. And so Anna was reminding me of that and saying, you know, do the breathing, and, you know, picture the temperature we need to hit. Well, my stupid math brain was running off and doing bad math.
Not 108, 107.
But I didn't, and I think it couldn't really have realistically gone much over 103, but who knows? I can't remember exactly the number. She probably has it written down in her notes somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't, during that, I was consciously thinking of him and what he taught me and what I needed to do.
So you could bring forward that kind of influence in your mind during that period.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It was a very peaceful place. So, and she was, you know, the distraction, frankly, was really welcome, because lying on ice and covered with ice is extremely uncomfortable.
It's an icy situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a cold place to be. So, in that respect, I did. My kidneys, I didn't know about until I was in back on the regular ward. And the next morning, a doctor came in who I hadn't met yet, whose patient I had just become. And she said, I'm not going to say that you'll be on dialysis forever. And I said, what? You know, it's like during the 5 days I was unconscious, certain things were happening that I'm not aware of. And, at that point, you know, I did a lot of kidney tests. The score you want is like right around 1.0, mm-hmm. The creatinine test for kidney health. My doctor told me that if it goes over 3, that's bad. And if it goes over 4, you might as well forget your kidneys. Mine went to 6.2.
Oh, no. Good gosh.
Yeah. By the time I woke up, or by the time the doctor came in and I was on the regular ward, and I had slept and sort of woken up with an awareness of where I was, it was at 2.9.
Oh, wow.
And it, by, that was October of 2009. By March the following year, it was 1.0.
Wow.
And so...
So I'm asking you if you met anyone in the visions, and you're basically saying you used the teachings from a fellow with high mastery, even though he wasn't current, you used those teachings to reverse some of your own situations. Would you say that? That's what it looks like.
Yeah. And he was on, he was still on the planet at that point. He had just, he was 99. He lived to be 101.
Wow, good. That's a good ad for him, isn't it?
Yeah. So it. So yeah, I did. I've always had this, and you might remember it, but I've, because we both, you were close friends with my mom, who was wonderfully very woo woo.
She was a remarkable body worker and healer.
Yeah.
Remarkable woman.
And growing up with her. And her sort of her spiritual quest, and being a contrarian by nature, I would always try to give her sort of grounding earth related connections to what I was hearing her talk about. She wasn't ever really very interested in that, because she was sort of much more interested in what's next than she was with where we currently were. And now she's enjoying what's next. And right before she died, I said, will you come back and tell me what's next and where you are? And she gave me a very coy look and said, no, you don't get to know.
Oh, that is hilarious, eh?
So, so I didn't, you know, I've heard of a lot of the stories, and I believe that a person's experience is their experience. And, you know, in mine, I was sort of glad coming out of it that I didn't go down toward a light, that I didn't, you know, that said to me that I wasn't right on that edge, even though physically I was, but I wasn't aware of it. And, you know, I like to think that, you know, being married to Anna, which will be 10 years this fall, that, you know, 2 years is not enough.
Exactly.
I'm going to get handed that gift.
I just want to say this, Ken. One of the things about you is that you're amazingly creative, right? Even in how you've handled your mother's what you called woo-woo, you're amazingly creative. So you would have had to do it your own way. And isn't the subjective reality our own way anyway?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So I look at this and I want to tell everybody at home that one of the reasons you and I have regained a communication is because your mother came to me from the other side, and she wasn't clear at her speech, which said didn't sound like her, but she'd had strokes. So that makes sense as a recognition pattern for me anyway, because that's the kind of experience I've had with people. But she told me to get in touch. Mm-hmm. And I trust that so much that I'm glad to be talking to you. And as we talk about near death, I just wanted to include that little piece as well.
Well, and I know, and you had said, you know, you had thought that it might have to do with one of my brothers. And I did contact him to say, hey, here's what Veronica heard and what mom is talking about. And he said, I think everything's going pretty well. She probably just wants out of my truck, because we all sort of, she wanted to be cremated and she wanted her ashes in the ocean. And my brothers all got, we all, the five of us got a fifth each of the calcium and
leftovers, yes.
Whatever's left. And so, and I was fortunate enough to have a job in Hawaii in late March. So my 1/5 of mom was released into the warm Pacific. I swam out and snuck her out of my bathing trunks in a plastic bag and set her free.
But I think maybe just talking with you and doing this and reading your book and making that connection was all she really wanted, really.
It could be, yeah, because
she's way more peaceful now.
Yeah, I know. And she was, as she was starting to fade, I was sitting alone with her in the hospital, I guess this was probably the day before she went to hospice. So it was 8 days before she passed. And I read her blip at the bedside, and it was not yet published and designed. It was just the draft I had on my computer. And I read it to her as she lay there peacefully with her eyes closed. And so that was a moment that meant the world to me. And I wasn't sure if she heard it or, you know, until I finished. And then she said, and I printed the story on the back of the book, but
I know, I love that.
She said, that was good. Who wrote that? I said, I did. And she said, is that your book? And I said, yes. And she said, that's good philosophy.
She was a wonderful spiritual woman, your mom as well.
Yeah.
So I'm chuckling because this book is really interesting. And I'm trying to get from you some exotic thing that happened in your near-death experience. But I think this book, as I read it, has, and I've read it once and bits and pieces a lot more, and it has this incredible, it's like a viewfinder through all of time and space in terms of a philosophical streak, isn't it? It's sort of like that mm-hmm. to me. I love that. Can you talk about your book to people and tell them what you were trying to do?
Absolutely. Well, having friends who know that I've, you know, written songs and poems and things, you know, the one said, I can't wait to see what you do with this experience. And I thought, yeah, what I want to do with this experience is, you know, get healthy again. So I didn't really think about it for a couple of years, but, one day on an airplane, some business trip,
Just hang on a sec. So your illness was 2008?
2009 in the fall.
Okay.
So, you know, by the spring of 2010, you know, we were, it took about 8 months to really feel like I was full strength. And I didn't think really about doing anything with it, with the experience from an artistic standpoint or a creative standpoint until I was on an airplane and I thought, we just waste our time doing so many things that don't mean anything to me anymore. And, you know, like I said, my level of urgency about the short time we have here was radically changed and focused. And so I wrote down a bunch of things that I thought we wasted our time on. And I thought, maybe I'll write a book about that. And then I looked at it later and I thought, that would be the most annoying book ever. And, you know, this is why you waste your time and you shouldn't waste the preciousness of, you know, I just thought people are going to hate that. So,
remember there's a famous poem that says getting and spending, we lay waste our hours, right?
Mm-hmm. So one day I woke up with this very strong feeling, three words, it's a fable. And I thought, it's just a really light-hearted, light touch kind of fable. That's what I should do. And I started writing it, and it came pretty fast. The first draft of it, which is always inspiring and cool, and it also means that there were going to be radical changes down the road as I start to work on it. But it grew into this sort of dual point of view, and the first half of the book. And I love the brevity of it. I, you know, was really touched growing up by Richard Bach's book Illusions, and that it was, there were very few words, but they were very poignant. And that I thought is something as a writer to sort of strive for. So I thought if it's a fable, you know, you can't really hammer somebody with a big, heavy narrative. So I decided to just tell it as it, it's almost a conversation. It's very brief. And some pages only have, you know, two or three words on them. It's, you know, my friend's joke that, you know, you wrote that book and it took me 20 minutes to read it.
But, hey, Ken, can I interrupt just for a sec?
Yes, absolutely.
I want to read a page that I just opened to, which says, this okay. theory was based on the observable randomness of nature. I love that. And it felt right and comforting to those who theorized it. To me, that kind of a line is a real nutshell on how we're marketed with thought and media stuff. Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
Well, and that's the really from the first half of the book that covers sort of the history of not just really the history of the Earth as a living, breathing planet in the outer spiral arm of our galaxy. And then the short time of its life that we've been here, and in that short time, what we've done and how we've tried to explain and find meaning in our lives. So it sort of looks at, you know, art and religion and science. And so that's where that passage comes from. And that some questions maybe aren't answerable, even though they seem like they are. And then the second half of the book is really a random person born somewhere on the planet. And, you know, some would argue that was probably me, except I don't connect myself to, I connect myself to the thought pattern, but this could be, it's some person, a human born somewhere on a random day who just decided to grow up and do the math and look at how the percentage of time that a human is alive compared to the percentage of time that the Earth will be here, that our little blip is so tiny, but no wonder we want to look and find meaning. And so the second half of the book explores the questions based on the things we sort of learned from the first half, that the this person explores all of that to come to their conclusion at the end of the book, which of course you should read. I shouldn't give it away.
And the but the book is called Blip, which is a really amazing title when you think about it. So reiterate what blip means. You've just said it, but say it in another way.
Well, there's that one is the you know, and the reason we did the artwork the way we did is that, you know, blip can refer to sort of like a radar, you know, a blip on a radar screen that shows that there's something out there that we're detecting. And also it can be a very short blip and it's gone. In this case, a blip of time that we're actually alive, that even if, you know, I'm in my 50s and Anna's grandmother lived to be 105, if you compare the percentage of time of our two ages against the time that the Earth has been around, there's not much difference in another, you know, 50 years. The number is still infinitesimally small. We, no matter how long we live as humans, we're not here very long in comparison to the time that the Earth is. So that, it was significant to me, and that's really probably the most obvious outgrowth of the near-death extravaganza, as I like to call it, because you become acutely aware that you could be gone in a blip. There's another use of the word. So we wanted to capture all of that. Like there's a signal out in space kind of idea that we're putting our thoughts out there. We're putting our ideas out there. We've actually shot rockets out there with our music and other things we and broadcasts that we put out there. There's that reaching out idea of a blip shooting across this vast space. There's the shortness of time and here today, gone tomorrow kind of thing.
Do you think a near-death experience kind of gives people like collapses that whole the mesmerizing sense of time and space just shifts it entirely so that we realize it isn't that way. Does that make sense?
I think it does. I think it does. On my own podcast, Blipcast, I'm calling it, and I've just started, so I'll have you on there. But one of the episodes that I spoke to a guy who said that awareness that I have, the level of urgency of it was ratcheted up by the experiences that I've had. Not that you need a near-death experience to have a higher level of urgency, but having experienced that and then having written this book, I look at world events and decisions and I look at everything differently because, you know, I sort of have to. That book is in physical print. I can't go out there and sort of return to who I was before because I'm a different person in that way.
But what's really exciting about that, Ken, is that not optimal in life to become? I'll Instagram this thing of becoming. You know, we don't want to be the same person we were. We really don't, do we?
Well, the duality of that is so amazing, though, because we don't. I think everybody would say, no, we should evolve and learn and grow and become and become and become. And yet at the same time, as humans, we're so resistant to change that the other side of us is going, no, don't change. No, I don't want to get older. No, I don't want to, you know.
I was writing the other day that we're really terrified of our own evolution at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I laughed at that, yes.
And I think it's kind of cool and good to be terrified by it and fascinated by it and all of the things that we are at once. That's sort of, you know, in one way what this book is about, that it's we like neat conclusions. We like to be able to say that is something that I know. And for me, getting shocked and moved into that place of suddenly not knowing anything, mm-hmm. was horrible, especially for the one that I was awake for in the taxi. But at the same time, it changes who you are, and it also makes it kind of fascinating to not know.
I wonder, when you're reversing your sickness inside your body and you're reversing these conditions that seem so dire, it is letting go of knowing in a way at a deep level, isn't it? I know this can't happen. Now I don't know. I actually don't know. It gives it permission, right?
Yeah, it's like I'd really like. I would like for it not to be happening, but at that time, and even now, doctors have no idea why it reversed.
Mm-hmm.
So, in my own life, I'm kind of a living example of something that was highly dramatic and not knowable. So I think, whoa, what if you apply that to everything? That turns out that's kind of a cool mental exercise.
And in Blip, I already wrote that one quote, and twice you've used the same word, random. Like, we make decisions based on kind of random thought processes rather than the actual unequivocal knowledge or real information. We make things up, don't we? And so we live in a world of making things up.
Yeah, we all have, you know, there are over 150 biases that have been named in psychology. We all have those, you know. I always think, I have a gut feeling about that. Is it a gut feeling or is it a bias? And
And does it come from past experience, or does it? Yeah, tell me about your yoga master.
Well, he said at one point, he said, you know, we tend to believe that every thought we have is a thought we have. It's not. Some of our thoughts are just automatically generated as a result of some bias that may or may not be based on anything that is good for us. Some of them are just chemical reactions because we are, after all, you know, these little chemistry experiments running around. So he always said, you know, be kind to your mind, look at your thoughts and determine which ones actually are you And yogis did a, there were, there's a, something called detachment that they practice, which is the best example of a quick explanation is that you put yourself in a small airplane and fly over your house. That's a different look than you have every single day. Every single day you're going in and out the doors or seeing it from the side. Even if you crawl up on the roof, you don't get that kind of perspective that you get if you fly over it a few hundred feet up in the air in a plane.
Exactly.
And so so the yogis would strive to push their awareness, part of their awareness, up to what they considered to be soul level. And then from that perspective of their soul, which is what he called it at the time, and you could probably, you know, use your own name, you have a sense of a more perspective on who you are and what's real and what's not for you. And then you strive to have that perspective in all things, which is impossible for everybody, but it's something that you strive to do. I remember the day that I said to him, I completely get that whole idea of detachment. It was this huge epiphany to me. And he gave me this, he used to make this face that I knew meant I had strayed completely off the path. And his crinkled up brow and his, you know, these quizzical eyes and this look like, what? Like almost like a dog turning its head, tilting its head sideways, you know, trying to figure out what was going on. And I said, what? I thought that would be kind of welcome news. And he said, I've been practicing it for almost 50 years and I don't get it. And I said,
wow.
No, I didn't mean to say I can do it. I just said that I understand the concept of it. And he breathed this huge sigh of relief and he goes, oh, okay, that makes sense.
Like, sure. But the other thing is when you're up high looking down like that, it shifts all relationships, doesn't it? It shifts mm-hmm. the relationship everything has to each other, including thoughts and feelings, eh?
Yeah, and there's a good I bought some of these when I was in Bali. There's a carving that you find all over Bali of this yogi in a lotus pose, but pulling his or her head down with the, you know, crossed feet, crisscross applesauce, as they said in my daughter's school. And it's like a little ball almost carved out of wood, but there's a figure of a person in there who's sort of wrapped up and looking in, and they call it the shy yogi at a lot of places. And he said, no, that's the humility pose.
Oh, wow. That's good.
That is the very pose that comes with the thought that this universe, this world, whatever spirituality there is so vast. And I am so tiny that not that I'm unworthy of to be part of it, but I'm part of it and I'm humbled by it. And that's what that pose comes from.
Wonderful. And, wow.
Oh, I love it. I just, you know, I when I was there, I kept buying them. There's ones the size of a tennis ball. I have one the size of a basketball. And I was like, why do I keep, I kept buying these things and I don't collect anything like that, but except guitars probably. And so I just, it was so, there was something that connected. And then when I think I gave him one as a gift and he said, oh yes, the humility pose. And I thought, if you can practice that detachment with that humility, then it just gives you a perspective that is hard to get when you're just wrapped up in the earthly things.
Well, and humility is a very high, to me anyway, it's a very high achievement for many mm-hmm. people. We're not taught that. That's something we have to kind of uncover, isn't it?
Right. And as he said, it's something that, you know, he spent decades trying to work out and figure out and do, and he was still working on it.
Well, you know that, and I'm really glad he would say that, because to me a really good teacher would be humble enough to say those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
What about you? Are you continuing to unravel more of the mysteries? I mean, you were already on a path of your own, right? Of discovery. Mm-hmm. Have you discovered, have you quantum leaped your discovery levels of self and self-empowerment and, comprehension of the universe ever since all this experience?
Well, it's funny because I, you know, I'll come around to that story that I told about my mom that I would, and that I was always trying to, you know, give her sort of an earthly perspective to, because I didn't feel like it was, you know, it's not happening here, it's happening somewhere else, which I don't know that she necessarily believed, but I interpreted it as that for a while. My yoga master friend believed he was this yoga master and he was a quantum physicist. That was his avocation.
Oh, wow.
He believed that everything in science could be connected seamlessly with everything in spirituality. And so that's really I used to say to my mom, if you're graduating from eighth grade to high school and high school is unknown and you could spend your time in eighth grade thinking, can't wait to get to high school, it's going to be so much better than eighth grade, but you're in eighth grade, experience eighth grade and all that it has to offer. And that was my little analogy for, you know, I don't know what's coming after the earth, but you know, right now you're here, experience everything that it has to offer. And because it's obviously going to inform what's next. And so that's the way I've sort of continued to look at it, because I think pondering the time that we have here and being really purposeful about how we live it and the balanced idea that he used to teach about, you know, a balanced life has all these aspects to it, spiritual, social, artistic, family and cultural, I guess. I can't remember exactly what they were, but that if you consciously try to balance that, this is a great little tiny golf ball in the middle of nowhere that we all live on to do that. Mm-hmm. So that's been my,
so it's the art of being.
Yeah.
That becomes a changeable, it's an ongoing journey of learning, isn't it?
Yeah. And we're going to get to later, you know, all we have is moments. Like, you know, he used to say the idea of reincarnation was first not about living life after life after life. It came about because of a yogic teaching about that you are born and you die in every moment.
Aha.
And I never researched that to find out if I just was so intrigued by that idea, because if that's the case and all we really have are those little blips that follow on each other, mm-hmm. we hope to have as many as we want. But even if we get as many as we want, we don't get that many.
No, really, really.
So why not really look at and marvel? Because there's so much about the physical part of being on the earth that links to spirituality. For me, like fractals, if you've ever looked into fractal patterns.
A little bit. That's not one thing I understand.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm. Just like, it's to me, mind-bogglingly cool.
That's almost like the holographic thing, isn't it? Where everything is just a small piece of something that is huge.
Yeah, the patterns
can be everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, on a cellular or subcellular level, you can take pictures of matter whose landscape looks exactly like a coastline. You know, that in every imaginable size, those patterns repeat throughout the physical world and even off of our planet, off into the universe. And if we're awake to those patterns, I think it's just fascinating because you see them everywhere. And I think there's also sort of cultural and mental fractals in a way that, you know, our minds, you know, we're only one species mm-hmm. on this little tiny planet. So, and I found out, you want to hear something that'll blow your mind if you have a second.
Yep.
In 2015, in Scientific American, there was this wonderful article about Homo sapiens, the species that we are. You know, there were a lot of human species for a while. In fact, they just found one. I just read an article this morning about another one that they just found in caves in Africa that now there's a new name, you know, Homo something, I can't remember the name. But, you know, we had Homo erectus and we had Neanderthals and we had all these different species running around. And somewhere in our DNA evolution, Homo sapien around 70,000 years ago evolved their DNA to collaborate with other beings who weren't part of their clan or family or immediate area. And that it was that, what they called collaboration gene, that made it possible for Homo sapiens to head out of Africa, where all of us were at one time, and proliferate around the world.
Wow. Well, that's really interesting, because there are other kinds of theories about how we intersected with different, you know, strength, bonded with different beings for strength and so on. Some of them are extraterrestrial, as you know. But we have to say goodbye right now. But I'm very delighted with this conversation and would like very much to do it again if you have time, some time, and tell people how to find you and how to find your book Blip, which I found really touching and
thank you.
Takes you through it.
Mm-hmm. We will continue. I'll have you on my podcast, and we can do a sequel anytime on yours.
And yours is called Blipcast. Blipcast,
and still to be released. It'll be everywhere here, hopefully by June 1st. I want to get five or so in the can before I post them.
Super.
But you can find the book at blipthebook.com, which has a few words about and a few reviews, and then links to Amazon. So you can, you know, or if you just go to Amazon and search Blip Ken, my book comes up first. So that is where I am. And you can, you know, I always tell people, please, the book is sparking really interesting conversations. This is one of them. And so the website is on the actual book itself. So if you read it and it sparks some interesting thoughts, please write and let me know, and I'll have you on the podcast, because I just think, you know, the more we humans interact, the better.
You got it. Well, thank you so much, Ken Boynton. And I'm so glad to keep connecting with you. It'll be great. It'll be great to keep learning about our own blips, eh?
Me too. Thank you so much. I'm glad we're part of each other's blips.
You betcha. So this is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you for tuning into Paradigm Shifters. And this will be podcasted over the next few days. So stay tuned.